Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Why did Donald Trump win the Electoral College vote? Well, today's guest, David K. Johnston, points to nearly 50 years of income stagnation. He understands this frustration because he's written about inequality for more than two decades. But David K. Johnston believes once Trump voters learn about his economic plans, they'll most likely regret their votes. Donald Trump wants to pass the biggest tax cut since Ronald Reagan. Over 10 years, his tax cuts for the 1% and corporations would cost more than $6 trillion. The top 0.1% of households, which includes Trump's, will get an annual tax cut of about $1 million each every year. The 1% will get $215,000 a year, and the bottom 20% will get $110. Corporate tax rates would be slashed from 35 to 15%, losing $2.6 trillion over 10 years. According to reports, the Republican-controlled Congress is considering ramming through tax reforms in the first half of next year using a fast-pass process called reconciliation that requires just 51 votes in the Senate. Joining us to talk about Donald Trump and his tax plan is David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. David teaches business regulation, tax law at Syracuse University's Law and Graduate Business Schools. He's the best-selling author of many books, including Perfectly Legal, Free Lunch, and The Fine Print. His most recent is The Making of Trump. We had David on a couple months ago talking about this. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me back, Rose.
Well, it's great to have you, David. It's the first time we've had you on since Election Day, and I've read a couple of the articles that you've written. I'd love to hear your analysis. The one piece you wrote for the National Memo was called The Trump Files, How His Huge Election Con Went Down. So you've had a couple weeks to think about this. How are you analyzing what we're currently facing?
Well, we are in completely uncharted territory here in that Donald Trump, who wanted to win the presidency but has very little interest in doing the job of being president, is now putting together a government of people, many of whom are in the extreme. And let me just give you one good example of that. Betty DeVos, the billionaire Michigan quote-unquote philanthropist from Amway, is an advocate of absolutely unregulated schools. And that would mean that someone could start a school where they're going to teach that, as the Old Testament says in Joshua 10, the sun stood still, which would mean the earth stood still. And, of course, that is a physical impossibility, but you can go on the Internet and find no shortage of people who will say, I just denigrated the scriptures and that, of course, this happened. It was a miracle. And, I mean, we're going to see in the first 100 days here the Republicans romp. They're going to go after worker rights, job safety, environmental laws, investor protections, the fiduciary rule, that is the duty of loyalty. I mean, everywhere that consumers, voters, and workers think they have protections, I think they are under assault.
And you also have written that you understand the frustration of Trump voters. You believe that this happened because of 50 years of income stagnation. But you also say that once they learn about his economic plans, they'll most likely regret their votes.
Well, Donald Trump, remember, said repeatedly that wages are too high. So people who think that the economic savior is Donald Trump were not listening to the message. And Donald, who's a master salesman, is a master con artist, and he found his marks, and he went after them. He took the complicated but very clear reasons that we have income stagnation at the bottom and lack of security, which I've written about in the best-selling trilogy of books and other places, and he reduced them to very simple matters. The reason you're so in such economic terror is the Mexicans, the Chinese, the idiot in the White House. As a master salesman, of course, Donald will say anything that will get him what he wants. Prior to running for president this time, he repeatedly said that Hillary Clinton would make a great president. On the campaign trail, of course, he says something totally different. And unfortunately, one of the realities of modern life is that television has this effect of normalizing things by just seeing them again and again and again, and people begin to accept the messages. It's the same principle of advertising. Why do you see the same ad over and over again for a shampoo or a beer? And it's because they're trying to get familiarity. And as I used to think when I had, having raised eight children, when I had teenagers, I didn't like exclusive dating on the theory that familiarity breeds attempt.
Speaking of wages, David, I just wanted to mention that minimum wage workers across the country are taking part in actions in 340 cities. Fast food, airport, and Uber workers have already been arrested in New York, Boston, all across the country. A number of workers are going to be gathering at SFO International Terminal today at noon. And again, these people, these workers are asking for $15 an hour from companies like Starbucks, where the CEO, Howard Schultz, makes about $10,000 an hour. The Chipotle co-CEO, Montgomery Moran, makes about $13,000 an hour, and their workers are asking for $15 an hour.
Well, and let's keep in mind that the minimum wage in this country in the mid-1960s, when I was a minimum wage worker, would be more than $11 today. If we could afford an $11 minimum wage when we were not nearly so wealthy in the 1960s, it's hard to imagine why we cannot afford it today. I've shown that the cook at a McDonald's, where many people basically outsource cooking in the same way that prosperous families 125 or 150 years ago had servants in their home, a cook at McDonald's today makes less and is economically worse off than a cook was in a home for a family in 1890.
What is in store for low-wage workers under a Trump administration? Stephen Greenhouse, a former labor reporter, although he still writes for the New York Times, says that unions are just dead under Trump.
Well, Trump is clearly going to do everything he can to weaken unions. Donald loves unions if they're under the control of his mafia friends. But any other unions, any independent, progressive, you know, honest unions, which is the vast majority of unions, he doesn't want anything to do with them. He doesn't believe in collective bargaining power for workers. And we are not going to fundamentally change the economics in this country until we address one of the most important core issues. There are only two kinds of return from economic activity. They either go to capital or they go to labor. And returns to capital have been steadily rising now. I mean, it's not a, maybe steadily is not the right word. They've been continually rising now for 35 years, ever since the beginning of the age of Reagan, which ended earlier this month. And returns to labor have been falling. Now, there have been some recent upticks, but they're very minor and they don't really change the overall trend. The fact is that workers do not have enough money to make the purchases of goods and services that will make the economy thrive, and people at the top have so much more money than they can possibly use that it is unproductive to keep adding to their wealth, particularly with all the devices they have available to defer taxes into the distant future.
Well, they're going to be getting a lot more money if Trump's tax policies go through. Over 10 years, his tax cuts for the 1% and corporations will cost over $6 trillion. The top 0.1% of households will get an annual tax cut of about $1 million. The 1% will get $215,000. What do we need to know about this tax plan, David?
Well, this is George Bush on steroids, and actually it's much bigger than Reagan's tax cuts. Remember, Ronald Reagan ran for office when we had a $1.2 trillion federal debt, saying we're going to balance the budget and pay off the debt, and then he went on a wild spending spree. George Bush came into office after 4 years of budget surpluses and said, my tax cuts will make us all better off, and I've every year since then tracked the money. And had we just stayed at the level of the year 2000, George Bush's chosen year for the base, Americans would have had $7.7 trillion more in income this century. That's enough money to pay all the income and payroll taxes and to pay off every car loan, every credit card loan, every student loan in America, and every family to have over $20,000 cash. The tax cuts were a disaster, and the new tax cuts will be more of a disaster. I mean, does anybody really think that people at the very top in this country need more money? Is that the economic problem we see, that wealthy people don't have enough money? No, the problem we have is they've got too much money to effectively benefit the economy, and people at the bottom are asset constrained. And one of the new things, Rose, that's coming along, I wrote about this first, I think, a year or two ago, it got some attention this week, is a concept known as ALICE. Our notion of poverty is based on work done in 1966 by a woman named Molly Orshansky, based on the average family's food budget. ALICE is a modern update of what constitutes poverty. It means asset limited. People don't have stocks or bonds or cash savings. Asset limited. Income constrained. They don't have enough income to really get by. Employed. So they're working, but they don't have enough income and they don't have assets to fall back on. And a family of four, where I live in Western New York, for example, needs, by the ALICE measures, an income of $60,000 to escape poverty. In Connecticut, you need closer to $65,000 to escape poverty for a family of four. The government would say that a family of four gets out of poverty at $24,000.
Looking specifically at that $6.2 trillion that would be lost over 10 years, where do you see that money coming from? Are we just going to gut social services even more? Or is the Trump administration, I should say, going to gut social services even more?
Well, that's the clear indication of the people who have been appointed so far to the various positions. Donald Trump has surrounded himself all his life with people who they don't need any kind of social services. These are people who own private jets. They own multiple homes. They may not live as gaudy and ostentatious a life as he does, but they don't have any need. And let me go back to Betsy DeVos, the new incoming education secretary. She believes that there should be absolutely unregulated education. You should be free to go to any school that you want. It doesn't matter where. You shouldn't be, you know, constrained by the zip code you're in, as she puts it, or the school district you're in. And by no regulation, she means very seriously, if you wanted to run a school that's going to teach the earth is flat, that would be just fine with her, because the market will decide whether parents want to send their children there. I mean, do we really want to live in a society where the education system depends on parents not, you know, having enough smarts to not send their school to places where they teach you crazy things? I just don't think a complete lack of standards makes sense. That doesn't mean I'm supporting the current system of how we run schools, but certainly completely unregulated market is a prescription for disaster, and it will make us poor because of the enormous complexity the world is acquiring every year in knowledge if people aren't equipped to adapt and make use of that knowledge.
Today we're speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter David K. Johnston. He's the author of many bestsellers, including Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch. His most recent book is The Making of Trump. Today we're talking about Donald Trump's tax plan. What questions do you have about this? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can tweet us, Your Call Radio, or leave a comment on our website. David, before we talk about more details, I just wanted to ask you about the process that the Trump team is planning to embrace in order to push through these tax cuts. Can you tell us how this works? According to reports, Congress is considering ramming through these reforms in the first half of next year using a fast-pass process called reconciliation that requires just 51 votes in the Senate.
Right. Well, the purpose of reconciliation is to limit the minority party's ability to delay, tack on amendments, et cetera. And this was how Obamacare was passed, the Affordable Care Act, because remember the leading Republicans vowed on the very night that President Obama took office and was holding his inaugural balls that they were going to make him fail. And they've publicly talked about that they set out to do this. There's no indication the Democrats are saying, we will make you fail. But they want to limit debate, and they want to do this as quickly as they can. And they can. They can do it very quickly, and they can do it retroactively, despite the assertion by Republicans like Chuck Grassley when he ran the Finance Committee that legislation should not be retroactive. He sponsored legislation in 2006 that was retroactive and which hurt kids who had gone out and gotten a job and saved money so they could go to college, penalized them retroactively. So I think you're going to see them push through a tax cut program heavily oriented toward people at the top. And this is not, let me be clear, this is not tax reform. One of the things they may do is undo a provision that has allowed hedge fund managers mm-hmm. to keep their money offshore untaxed. The real issue there is not the lower tax rate, called the carried interest rate. It is if you can earn money today and not have to pay taxes on it for 5, 10, 20, 40, 50 years, it's the time value of the money that's more important. Likewise, a lot of the offshore profits that they're going to allow repatriation of at an extremely low rate, that was money siphoned out of the United States, and now you're going to be rewarded for having done that instead of saying, hey, you're going to have to pay up, which Congress could also do and bring that money back here.
We have a related question about policy from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show. Hi, Greg.
Hello. Yes. Can you hear me?
Yep. Go ahead.
Okay. A couple of things. One is I know you're dealing with taxes, and I want to get to that. But I wanted to ask you a broader question, and it's this. If he's able to carry out these policies and the Democrats don't really end up being obstructionists, which I think they should be, I'm just wondering what you see down the road 2 to 4 years. I mean, if he is able to implement not just his tax policies, but all the policies that are going to come from these appointments that he's got, the Supreme Court, et cetera, and the fact that we're going to be in really bad shape in 2 to 4 years, given what he's trying to do in all these areas. And I'm just wondering if you have any insight into where you think how bad things could be.
Yeah, Greg, I mean, I think you've hit upon the right thing. Trump has proposed a number of things that are mutually exclusive. You can't reduce the budget deficit and have this enormous tax cut at the top. It is not possible. Anybody who's ever had to do an input-output table in economics can tell you it's not possible to have the kind of economic growth he's talking about, and it's not going to be sufficient because the growth is going to go to people who will be at these much lower tax rates. He's not going to be able to do an infrastructure program, which would hire a lot of semi-skilled and unskilled workers without money unless you follow the Putin pattern, or should I say the Russian pattern, where you have oligarchs who basically steal the Commonwealth, and you pay much more for that in the long run than if you simply invest tax dollars in the Commonwealth goods and services that make private wealth making possible. I think that we will see the dollar losing its prestige around the world and its reliability. Very likely, we may well see huge new budget deficits, which would be big enough, I think, to constrain private investment, despite all the favors that they have. And you will see more downward pressure on wages as the remaining unions are fought, and there's efforts to do things like scale back the Fair Labor Standards Act. There actually are some people around the Trump appointees who are now writing that this is a great opportunity to get rid of the child labor laws because children should be stocking the shelves at Walmart. It will teach them discipline.
I mean, didn't a paper that Betsy DeVos wrote say something about child labor?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're dealing with people who have pretty extreme views about these things. And the common characteristics of them are that they are very doctrinaire libertarians who believe in everything should be done by contract, as if everybody's smart enough and economically oriented enough to do it and ignoring the inefficiencies of everything being done by individual contract. Or they are people of such enormous wealth that they really have no connection to how most people live. Betsy DeVos went to private schools. Her children went to private schools. The schools that she brags about are in Western Michigan are private schools for well-to-do kids where they have scholarships for some poor kids. But these are not the institutions that affect the lives of most people in America.
Mm. Today we're speaking with David K. Johnston, tax reporter, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. David, how will the Republicans sell this plan? I mean, one of the myths that's been perpetuated by Republicans is that these lower corporate tax cuts, corporate taxes will lead to economic growth and jobs. I mean, we heard this over and over during the George W. administration, and it's repeated by the media without being seriously challenged. And in a piece you wrote in The Nation last summer, you wrote that the 2004 American Jobs Creation Act gave multinationals an 85% discount on offshore profits brought home. When the proposal was being discussed, proponents said it would create over 600,000 jobs. But as soon as the law took effect, its biggest beneficiary, Pfizer, fired 40,000 workers, and Pfizer escaped about $10 billion in taxes. Can you talk about that?
Well, you can design a repatriation of foreign profits in a way that would result in more jobs. The problem is the Republicans would never do that because then you'd be telling corporations how to spend their money. So if we repatriate all this offshore money, Google, for example, has more than $200 billion in cash. They can't even invest it. It will have some positive effects. For example, if Apple suddenly declared a very large dividend, it would put money into a lot of people's pockets, but most Apple stock is owned by people who are already prosperous. It doesn't do anything about the bottom 90%. But for this issue of Trump and his election, I would be finished now with my book where I've created an entirely new tax structure for the 21st century economy that works for every modern country. And I've written most of the statutory language for the U.S., and we are continuing to keep a tax system that was designed over 100 years ago for an industrial economy, and we don't live in that world anymore. The most valuable things we make in America are molecules and strings of numbers, and the ownership of those you can put anywhere in the world, and you can send the profits to some place that isn't taxed. Apple sends it to, as Apple has testified under oath, nowhere. And there is no legislature in nowhere, so there are no taxes in nowhere. So we need a whole new tax system. This is just more favors for the political donor class, for the people who provide jobs for members of Congress when they leave office and their kids. And it is not draining the swamp. It is, sending forth new crocodiles.
How do you think what should happen with a company like Apple, which holds about $202 billion in cash? That's about $633 per American, far more than right. The company could possibly need for investments. How do you think a company like Apple should be dealt with when it comes to taxes?
Well, Congress settled this originally in 1909. It imposed a limit on how much you could hold in liquid assets because a company's managers who are risk-averse will simply take all the profits they don't need to reinvest to grow the business and put them into what amounts to a mattress. Now, imagine what happened if everybody cashed got their paychecks in cash, took the money home, and put it in the coffee can. The economy would fall apart. You have to have money being circulated. So there's a law that says if you have excess cash reserves, liquid holdings, you will pay the corporate income tax on it and a 15% penalty tax. During Reagan's administration, five words were added to the tax code that exempted money if it was taken out of the country and put overseas. That's why you've seen this explosion of subsidiaries offshore. I've said that Congress should repeal that section and should give companies 5 years to return all the money over 5 years, and if they haven't, then they'll pay the 15% penalty tax on top of the corporate income tax. That would be a stimulus, and it wouldn't cheat everybody else who's been paying their taxes. One of the fundamental things that's going to happen here under the Republican plan is a trend I've written about for years where the income tax is morphing into a labor tax. You don't get your paycheck or your pension check or your 401k, which is just deferred wages, without the taxes being withheld. But if you're Donald Trump, who's lived tax-free, as best we know, since 1977, if you are a sophisticated investor, or if you're very, very wealthy and you simply borrow against your assets to live and therefore, to the eyes of the government, have no income, the system is not working. And the IRS has testified that they do not have the capacity to understand and take apart many of the modern tax shelter devices that corporations and individuals are using. So what this is really speeding up is going towards a system in which capital is minimally taxed or not taxed at all. If you look at the deferral into the future, it really can be a profit center. The many big companies, Apple among them, turn a profit off their taxes, but they report for accounting purposes that they pay taxes. And you're shifting the burden on to workers. And people don't understand this because it's really complicated stuff.
Today we're speaking with David K. Johnston.
I hope not.
If you'd like to come on the show, he's invited. David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. Actually, we'd probably ask him some questions that he hasn't been asked in the last year during his 24/7 coverage. David is a best-selling author of Perfectly Legal, Free Lunch, and The Fine Print. His most recent book is The Making of Trump. Today we're talking about Donald Trump's economic plan, specifically focusing on taxes. And we'll take more of your phone calls after this break.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you prefer to write rather than call, you may email us to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may leave a comment at yourcallradio.org, or you may tweet us at yourcallradio. BBC World Have Your Say at 11 o'clock. They'll be talking about that plane crash in Colombia and the Brazilian soccer team that it obliterated. Stay tuned.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about the Electoral College. Hillary Clinton now has 2.2 million more votes than Donald Trump, but he won more Electoral College votes. The Electoral College, many say, undermines a fundamental principle of democracy. That's one person, one vote. A vote in Wyoming is actually three times more powerful than a vote in California. So is it time to get rid of the Electoral College? That's what we're discussing tomorrow. Today, we're talking about Donald Trump's economic plan, specifically his tax plan. We're speaking with David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. Check out his recent book, The Making of Trump. We had David on a couple months ago talking about this. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. And David, before we go back to calls, we're talking about the Electoral College on tomorrow's show. There's so much attention now on the Green Party's efforts, actually successful efforts, for a recount. Jill Stein has raised over $5 million. What are your thoughts on that and the fact that that issue is getting a lot of attention, but not really what the Democrats did wrong? I mean, Stephen Greenhouse in the New York Times reports that the union spent $100 million to defeat Donald Trump. But when you look at union households, Clinton won very narrowly, about 51% to 43%.
Well, the audits, and that's what these effectively are, the recounts, aren't going to change anything. We do want to make sure that we have elections that are properly counted. 24 years ago, my wife, who's now the CEO of a big nonprofit, was hired to turn into plain English the study by computer scientists that showed how easy it would be to manipulate the vote results. And we have at least three court rulings in America where judges held that the proprietary rights, the property rights, of the companies that make vote counting software to keep secret how it works trumped the public's right to be assured that if you vote for candidate A, it's reported as voting for candidate A, not candidate B. I think we should be very worried about that. I'm very much in favor, particularly in view of what we know the Russians have been doing to hack into various places and interfere in America, that we probably should go to paper ballots. The Canadians have paper ballots mostly, and they don't have the kind of issues that we have. And as for, you know, boxes that disappear and things, that's where the parties are important. You have two people. You don't let a deputy sheriff drive off alone with the ballot. You make the deputy sheriff drive off with one Democrat and one Republican and go to have the ballot box counted. I think it's fascinating, though, that Donald Trump has picked up this story from InfoWars, Alex Jones's crazy conspiratorial website, claiming that, you know, millions of dead people and millions of illegal people and millions of double and triple voters affected the election. It's just made up nonsense by a crazy man. Mm-hmm. But Donald Trump treats the things that he reads at the website InfoWars as legitimate and real, and sooner or later that's going to cause a big problem for the United States of America.
As a longtime journalist, David, you started here in California, you've written for the New York Times and so many media outlets. Donald Trump will pick up things from InfoWars. Donald Trump will tweet at 11 p.m. and then the media just run with it all day. How do you think the media should deal with this over the next 4 years?
This is actually a really big problem, and I am working right now with some other people where we're trying to see if we can devise a supplemental news organization that I would run to address these matters. We got to raise several million dollars to do it and do it right. There were 60% more journalist jobs in this country in 2000 than there are now. There has been a well-financed 40-plus-year campaign to discredit news organizations. There are plenty of people who will tell you absolutely crazy things and ask, you know, why isn't this in the New York Times? I mean, where I live in Rochester, New York, I've had college-educated, successful business people ask me why I'm not writing about Hillary Clinton's hit squads and the more than 50 people she's had murdered. There's something very serious going wrong here in terms of the theory of the United States of America, which is that rational debate and facts will lead us to smart self-governance. And unfortunately, the national news organizations, even the New York Times and the LA Times, don't seem to be equipped to deal with having in the White House a man who is fundamentally a mountebank. He's a con artist. He spent his entire life cheating people, being involved with violent felons for profit, and they don't get it. My book tells about Donald Trump's, all from the public record, there's no unnamed source of this, it's all public record, Donald Trump's extremely deep involvement and inexplicable involvement with one of the biggest cocaine traffickers in America. Donald Trump risked everything he had just to tell this drug trafficker he was his loyal friend. And his name was never mentioned on the three TV networks, on PBS, in the five big newspapers, by the AP, by Bloomberg. None of those places just even mentioned his name. So people have no idea about who Donald Trump really is. That's why I wrote The Making of Donald Trump.
Mm. And yet, in the business section of the New York Times over the weekend, I really thought I was reading an Onion story, a piece by Robert Frank called A Donald Trump-Led Trip Back to the Gold-Plated 80s. And this reporter said that the wealthy are already partying like it's 1989. And Mr. Leach from Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous was quoted in this story saying, in the next 4 years, it'll be okay to be rich again. The cars will get bigger. The houses will be more luxurious. It'll be okay to wear jewelry and gowns. I mean, this was a story in the business section of the New York Times.
Right. Well, I think the story was intended to, you know, sort of draw attention to it, not to glorify it. But yes, that's exactly what's happening. And, you know, FDR, a wealthy man throughout his life who came after he developed polio to understand poverty and pain in America, you know, said, and I will get the word slightly wrong here, that the measure of a country is not how rich its best-off citizens are, it's how well it takes care of the unfortunate members of that society. And, you know, we can build a healthy, broadly prosperous society. This is not an administration that is going to do that, and the people who have been appointed aren't going to fit that. I mean, Wilbur Ross, as Commerce Secretary, is being written up as someone who saved companies. Well, no. He went in, he reorganized companies, he took out a bunch of money for himself, and then the companies folded. Now, maybe they would have folded anyway, but they would have folded without enriching Wilbur Ross so that he's a multi-billionaire. And I think, you know, the spigots are now open for more monopolies. That was in my book, The Fine Print, for more subsidies, here in Western New York, we just approved all sorts of subsidies for casinos.
Hmm.
Casinos! Subsidies for casinos? This is going to be, as Robert Frank wrote, you know, real party time for people to talk. By the way, one important point, Rose. Half of the 1% are two-income working couples who make $400,000 to $600,000 a year. That's a lot of money. But those are people who work every day. They get 81% of their income from salaries, and when you add up, you know, if they're professionals, like from a law firm, it's about 90% of their income. We shouldn't confuse the bottom half of the 1% with the people at the top. The top tenth of 1% have roughly as much income as the bottom 150 million Americans.
Wow.
That's the group to focus on, the $2 million and up crowd, the 202 workers who last year were paid an average of $91 million each.
Mm.
That's the group you want to focus on.
David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. His latest book is called The Making of Trump. And let's hear from Nancy in Berkeley. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm still recovering. I'll probably be recovering for the rest of my life. But what I wanted to say is, first of all, I think we have not recovered from Ronald Reagan's reign in office. But I don't think we'll ever recover from Trump if he is able to do what he plans to do. And I'm just wondering, this might be pretty simple, but in order to pay for, you know, his tax credits, etc., it seems to me that our social programs, such as they are, our free education, public schools, etc., our Medicare, Medicaid, those are the things that are going to be suffering. Those are the things that are going to be done away with. I'm wondering how long it's going to take these people who have been conned by Donald Trump to realize what has happened or what is happening. I think it's going to take a very long time. But anyways, I just wanted to get your views on that.
I think we have reached the end of the age of Reagan. Trump's win is the end of the age of Reagan. We're in a new age. For the moment, I call it the age of authoritarianism, because Trump is an authoritarian who thinks that as president he's either the king or the dictator. And sooner or later that will lead to real problems. George Lakoff, a professor of cognitive science at Berkeley, says, and I think correctly, that Trump is appealed to people who want the stern father figure to lead the country and this authoritarian rule. But Lakoff also points out that if you break the bond when people see a leader as a strong father figure, they really, really get antagonistic.
Mm-hmm.
And so if Trump messes this up, I think we could see a very sharp change in the country, but absolutely there's going to be tremendous damage. The Republic should survive Trump, but it won't be without damage.
How do you think nonprofits will be affected by a Trump presidency? Today is Giving Tuesday, and my email box is filled. I feel like more than ever, so many nonprofits are realizing that they're going to have a lot of work to do in the next 4 years on a shoestring budget.
Well, nonprofits generally provide services much more efficiently and effectively than either government or business. There's lots of research that shows that. There are exceptions, but overall, much more efficient way to provide things. There's going to be a lot of assault on nonprofits. This nonprofit news organization that I'm working with some other people trying to see if we can raise the money to start, one of the things I keep hearing back from people is, you watch, Trump will try to get the IRS to not approve your status, to block what you're doing. Be interesting to see if that's a problem. I think that government funding of nonprofits will be significantly less, especially in the area of healthcare. And we're going to see major assaults here on healthcare, even though before he ran for president, Donald Trump said more than a few times that he believed healthcare was a right, and in fact told me once that it should be like driving down the street in front of your house. You don't pay a marginal fee for it. You just go on it because it's a public good. Of course, now he's arguing something radically different.
Mm. Well, thank you for calling in, Nancy. Let's go next to Judy in Berkeley. Hi, Judy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I would like to know why everybody invariably insists that the recall count won't change anything. I don't understand that. I am so upset. And it seems to me that when states win by only 10,000 votes and 20,000 votes, and there's something funny in the way they won those votes, that it could change. Why do they do that?
Well, Judy, the reason you're hearing that is Hillary Clinton's own legal staff, and they had lawyers in every state, you know, to watch the vote count. They have demographic people. They spent a lot of money on people. They didn't find anything in the voting patterns they thought was troubling. They're not challenging the election. The reason they're participating in Jill Stein's motion is their belief, and I think they're right, that if you're going to have a recount, then the Democrats should be involved in that, and I think the Republicans should too. The issue really is that we have this anachronism of the Electoral College. Now, if we got rid of the Electoral College and a pure popular vote, the downside to that is that, well, Wyoming, as Rose pointed out, votes count three times as much there as in, California?
Right.
Votes in Wyoming would count for nothing. Presidential candidates could be elected based on the Boswash Corridor, metropolitan Chicago, and the West Coast, and by that I mean the coast side of the West Coast, not inland California, and that would also have its own negative consequences. But I don't see any likelihood that we're going to have a serious discussion about reforming or getting rid of the Electoral College right now. What you're seeing is a shrinking minority party that is trying in every way it can to hold on to power. So we have voter suppression, we have voter identification, we have physical threats, we have the partial removal of the Voting Rights Act, and I will not be surprised if we very quickly see the entire Voting Rights Act removed by Congress, and the creation of districts that corral Democrats so that they are – Democrats got many more votes than the numbers they have in Congress would suggest that they have.
Well, we will talk about these issues tomorrow with Lawrence Lessig, so I hope you can tune into that. Thank you for calling in.
He's the guy. Yep. He's the guy to talk to about it.
Yep, and he'll be on tomorrow. Thank you again, Judy. Let's go next to Stephanie in San Francisco. Hi, Stephanie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. My first impression when I realized that Donald Trump had won was that I did not want to pay taxes to a Trump president, not just because I felt like I shouldn't, since he didn't, but because I feel like he's a major threat to our democracy. I'm wondering if your guest has any advice on how a regular person might legally be able to do some of the same things that Donald Trump did, either by diverting some of our federal tax money to our states or charities, or if there's any other suggestion on how, you know, a mass group of people might be able, you know, via civil disobedience, send a message to him that way.
Stephanie, first of all, just remember, you're paying taxes for the United States of America. Donald Trump is not the king or dictator, however much you may think that he is. You're paying them for the United States of America. I wrote a satirical piece for Bill Moyer's Public Square Media that you can find on the internet very quickly about, you know, how to not pay taxes like Donald Trump. And I think one of the things I would encourage people to do is this screwy tax deal that the New York Times first wrote about and then I then explained, and since then a number of law professors have agreed that my explanation is the right one, shouldn't be allowed, and Congress could cut off his future tax benefits in a minute. All they have to do is say, anybody who had tax benefits as of this date, you no longer get them. Ethically, Donald Trump, as president of the United States, should do exactly that. He should support such a law. He won't. But as an ethical matter, he should, because it's his self-interest. I calculate that Trump is unlikely to pay taxes before 2042, when he would be 96 years old. This is a real problem. The bigger problem I'd be worried about is Donald Trump's deep financial involvement all around the world. There was an extraordinary piece in the New York Times about his involvement. I had just finished reading yesterday a yet-to-be-published 12,000-word article about everything that a friend of mine could find in the public record about Trump and the Russian oligarchs. And after reading 12,000 words, my immediate thought was, man, we don't hardly understand at all how deep this relationship is and how inimical it is to the national security interests of the United States.
Wow. And where will this be published?
I'm not at liberty to tell you about it because they're still negotiating the terms. But, I mean, it'll get published. It'll be out there soon.
Okay.
And you'll hear about it when it runs. But many of the oligarchs in Russia are world-class criminals. Trump is involved with many of these world-class criminals, just as he's involved deeply with many vicious, violent criminals here in America that I detail all from the public record in the making of Donald Trump.
Mm. So as Donald Trump doesn't pay taxes, his plan would increase taxes for almost 9 million families. About 20% of households and more than half of single parents would pay more in taxes. Can you tell us about that?
Well, this fits perfectly the Republican meme that, you know, mothers of children should be married. They're not quite willing to go so far as you should stay home, but they really want to set up a tax system in which single parents, doesn't matter if you're single because, say, you were widowed, single parents are going to be punished because this just doesn't meet the right-wing Republican meme. And the problem with that meme is this, the argument made on the right that marriage creates strong family economics has it exactly backwards. All the evidence I've seen shows that strong economics create strong family units. We have the lowest divorce rates and the most enduring marriages in the prosperous blue states like Massachusetts. And we have the worst demographics in the poor red states like Alabama and Mississippi.
I'm glad you brought that up because Reveal had a really good segment about welfare and how we are at a time when cash assistance is at its low point. More money is being spent on these marriage counseling programs across the country than cash assistance to low-income and poor people.
Yeah, it's very important to say welfare for low-income families. I mean, Donald Trump is one of the biggest welfare recipients in the history of the world for a single project in which he did not invest a single dollar of his own money. He got $400 million of welfare just from the city of New York. Many of the people at the very top are in, and that's what my book Free Lunch was about, these hidden subsidies that take money out of your pocket in ways you don't detect, and give them to people like Wilbur Ross and Donald Trump and Warren Buffett. Mm. And it is a massive socialist redistribution scheme upwards.
David, we have about 4 minutes left, and I'm willing to bet that a lot of Trump voters in rural areas don't know much about these policies because they don't really have media there. When I was covering Standing Rock about a month ago, driving to Bismarck, North Dakota to host this show at 11 a.m., and North Dakota time, the only station you could really get that was, I don't want to call it news, but was Rush Limbaugh. I mean, the public station there was playing classical music at 11 a.m. So people in not even rural areas, Bismarck, North Dakota, they don't have access to this information.
Right.
And it's easy for us to say, well, go read reports, go online. But frankly, people should have a radio they should turn on and they should get information. That's the point of journalism.
Yes, and unfortunately, because of this long campaign to say you can't trust the quote-unquote liberal media, never mind that, you know, it's verified information and they correct when they make mistakes, this has had a corrosive effect. And I've been many places in the traveling I do around the country where you can only hear Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh or religious fundraising. And the public stations are, in many cases, really cowed. I mean, they're very afraid Congress is going to cut off all their money, so they play classical music because that's safe and highbrow and it doesn't risk the ire of people whose attitude is anti-democratic. You shouldn't be able to have access to news that they don't like. Now, there's some of that on the left. There is a lot of it on the right, and that's where the economics have been that are encouraging this kind of distorted understanding of how systems work.
It sounds like your new media venture will tackle this, but what are the solutions to these major problems?
Well, one of the most important things that needs to be done, and this is what I would do if I can raise the money to start this thing, is none of the changes that are going to be made by the new administration can be done overnight. They have to go through a rulemaking process. They have to go through a legislative process. And the problem is the news media will cover controversies where both sides talk about them. They don't go in and cover how these things happen, and they don't tell you in advance can't tell you how many times I pick up my New York Times or Wall Street Journal and it says, well, the president signed this or this rule took effect. And it's like, wait a minute. I don't want to know about this now. I want to know about it when they're starting the process in case I want to complain about it. And that's what we would do. We would get ahead of the curve on these things if I can raise the money. And we got to raise, by the end of the month, I got to raise $1.2 million if I'm going to do this. I've recruited really good people who will come, but I got to have the money to make it happen.
Is there any way we can learn about this venture online?
There will be something next week at davidcayjohnston.com. I'll probably have it up Monday.
All right.
davidcayjohnston.com.
So speaking of taking action, is what can people do who oppose Donald Trump's tax plan?
Well, I think you need to write to lawmakers and say, you know, we don't need more tax cuts for the rich. You should write and point out that if we have a lower tax rate for businesses than individuals, wealthy people will keep their money in companies. They won't pull it out and put it in their own pocket. And it only takes a 1 percentage point difference for that to happen. Lots of research shows that. They're talking about a 18 percentage points difference. And if you allow people to borrow money effectively against from their companies or their business assets, they can live tax-free. So I would just... You write to your lawmakers and have them draw the line. We don't need more tax cuts for wealthy people.
And here in California, we'd be writing to Democrats. If the Republican-controlled Congress is going to use this fast-pass process, what can Democrats do in response?
I don't know they can do a lot, but you know what? They should not be allowed or encouraged to sort of fold on this. They should be very tough about it. Elizabeth Warren was quite right, you know. On bigotry in particular, she said that we're not going to make compromises. Well, there shouldn't be compromises about tax policy that damages the country but benefits the oligarchs.
David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. His most recent book is The Making of Trump. David, thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you back soon.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, we'll discuss the Electoral College. Hillary Clinton now has 2.2 million more votes than Donald Trump, but Trump won more Electoral College votes. The Electoral College undermines a fundamental principle of democracy: one person, one vote. For example, a vote in Wyoming is 3 times more powerful than a vote in California. Is it time to get rid of the Electoral College? What would it take? Join us live at 10 a.m. with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.